Today's episode is sponsored by Palo Alto Networks and its Prisma Sassy, where AI-powered innovation takes center stage. Watch the new Palo Alto Networks virtual event on demand to hear how the latest innovations in Sassy can help your organization. See how ZTNA 2.0, Cloud Secure Web Gateway, and SD-WAN deliver exceptional security and ROI. Watch on demand at paloaltonetworks.com/engage/sassy-signature-moment.
Welcome to Heavy Networking, coming to you from the Packet Pusher since 2010. If you've ever wondered why OSPF inter-area communication must flow through the backbone area, or have ever used bogons found outside of RFC 1918 on your internal network, hey, you found your tribe. I'm Ethan Banks, and with me is Drew Conrey-Murray. You can find us on LinkedIn or the Packet Pushers community Slack group. Visit packetpushers.net to find all the links, if you care, because you might not care, and I respect that. On today's episode, we're discussing what it's like to be the maintainer of an open source project. Our guest is Sribatspi, the creator of Ostinato. Ostinato is a traffic generator and packet crafter that's been around for quite a long time. Sribats has been using the open source freemium model to feed his family for quite a while now, but open source with freemium has its challenges. Sribats, welcome to Heavy Networking. And man, you and I have known each other because of Ostinato for kind of a long time. And I know when you started Ostinato and made it open source, in part it's because you were a true believer in open source, man. It was like where your heart and soul was. And I guess to some degree still is, but why the true belief in open source?
So, I mean, what's not to love about open source, right? As a user, it's all good. I mean, everyone starts off as a user, right? So you have, as an individual end user, you get free, as in free beer. You get a whole variety of software, right? I mean, I don't have to buy Office 365 today. I can just use LibreOffice with almost the same set of features. And even for the same one thing that you want to do, you have a wide variety of different alternatives that you can use. So, I mean, as a user, it's all good. And even maybe as a company or a creator, you build on top of other open source projects, right? Because otherwise, if you had to build everything yourself, that's going to take a lot of time, a lot of work. So software as it exists today wouldn't exist without open source. I mean, if we're being honest here, open source is quite a big role to play. And as they say, we stand on the shoulder of giants, and the giants here is the open source software. So even philosophically, right, the whole idea of community contributions and so on, the whole cathedral and bazaar stuff, I mean, that quite resonated with me. And okay, I'm probably dating myself by talking about cathedral and bazaar, but so... So in fact, funnily enough, my first encounter with open source was when Netscape open sourced Mozilla. I think that's stating even further. Okay, so I mean, I was so inspired by that. I was back in university at the time. A friend of mine and myself, we had written some software that we had held very close to our chest. And just inspired by that whole thing, we open source that stuff, saying, yeah, we also want to do an open source stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I've been a long time believer and supporter of open source. So as a user, I think it's all great. And I mean, except one part, right? I mean, the open source talks about user freedom and so on. But as open source stands today, I think that freedom part is not, that promise has not been realized. For example, I have a smart TV today, and for some reason, the screen scraper never kicks in, and there's nothing in the menu to enable or disable it. Now, I'm very sure that smart TV is actually built on top of a bunch of open source stuff, but I can't go and find the source code anywhere to figure that out, right? I mean, as a geek, I would go and want to figure out why is it not working, where is it? But I mean, that promise hasn't held out. But otherwise, I think as an open source user, I think people don't realize the other side, the side of open source they don't see. But as a user, I think it's quite good. And everyone starts out as a user.
So, right, good for the users. And so from your user experience of open source, then you decided, I'm going to do some open source work, or I'm going to build, make some software. And because I've had such a good experience as a user, I want to make my project open source. Is that kind of the logic?
That's right. So, I mean, when I released Ostinato as open source back in 2010, it was my contribution back to the community. I mean, the community from which I had taken so much, I been a long time user of open source software. I wanted to contribute back, and I treated this as my contribution back to the community and the open source world as such.
So as an open source maintainer, what's it like dealing with people, people who are using your software, people who are contributing to your software? How's the people interaction like?
So on the whole, quite good. And I think this is not related to open source, but one of my pet peeves is how people report bugs. You know, all you'll get is it's not working. I mean, no topology, no IP addresses, no information about what they did, what they expected to happen, what actually happened, nothing of that sort, right? I mean, that education hasn't yet rubbed off. But I think that's not true. I mean, that's true for even, I mean, not just for open source, even otherwise. But yeah. On the whole, I think the open source community is quite good and quite nice. People are respectful. People realize that they're getting something for free and they don't make too many demands. They ask for things politely, report bugs politely. But then like every other community, there are some bad apples. And yes. It's human nature, right? Even one bad negative interaction sort of clouds all the other positive things. And it just quite disproportionately. And that's where you get into trouble, right? So, I mean, there is this sense of entitlement, right? I mean, people have gotten something for free. They're using it for their work, or they're on a deadline of some sort and they run into an issue and then they expect you to jump in and solve immediately. The bug fix has to happen now because I am at a deadline and this is a free software that I'm using and you need to fix it now. Right. Or they'll say, get on a call and solve this for me. Sometimes this is not possible. And if I push back saying, okay, I'm ready to do that, please pay me a consultation rate. And then they'll jump in and say, why? I mean, this is open source software. How can you charge for it? How can you ask money for it? So, I mean, that sort of things are there. And then you also have to deal with, again, maybe not again an open source thing, but something that's stuck me, right? I mean, periodically it strikes me, right? I mean, network engineers, things that surprise me about network engineers at times, how many of them don't know the relation between packet size and bandwidth? And they'll say, I'm not getting full line rate. Say, okay, are you using 64 byte packets? Yes. Then you're not going to get full line rate. Please go and change it to either a jumbo or a 1500 or something. So and then just stuff like that, right? Or for example, what MAC addresses to fill in when I'm crafting a packet, right? Source MAC address they'll put, but whether it's routing or switching, what destination MAC address to populate. So, I mean, I also live on the other side of the world, right? I live in India and most of my users are in the US. So there's this whole time zone thing. So, and especially when you're interacting over a mailing list or a forum, they'll ask a question. I'll see it next day. I'll answer. They'll answer the next day back. So a lot of impatience builds up. And then they're upset that things are not working and I'm not helping them. And I'm asking for money and to get on a call. So then people get upset and then they write nasty things.
So do you have a way of dealing with bad apples?
So, I mean, you initially try and handhold them and try and help them. But if it goes beyond a point, you draw a firm line and say, this is not acceptable. Unless you tone down or
change your
have some respect, we're going close this down right now.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So there is an open source researcher, Nadia, some time ago. I don't know if you ever had a chance to look at it. So she did a bunch of open source research for about 5 years. And so one of her findings, for example, was the top 100 GitHub repositories. I mean, she made a list of the top 100 projects on GitHub. And 2/3 of those projects are actually maintained by only one or two people. Mm-hmm. Right? This is like the top 100 of GitHub. And there's only one or two people maintaining the whole thing. And since open source has been there for a long time, but since then the number of users of open source has like exploded by magnitudes, right? But that level of explosion, I mean, that level of increase has not happened either on the maintainer level or the contributor level.
Right.
So the ratio of users to contributors or users to maintainers is like huge. And that like creates a power imbalance in the system. And that is a cause of lot of heartache, if you will.
Sure.
In fact, Nadia has a very nice talk called Consider the Maintainer, which presents things from the maintainer's point of view, what they go through.
Now, at some point, and I think we're starting to hear some of the reasons why, but at some point you started charging for downloads that had been available for free earlier. So what was your thought in that?
So 2000 was when I released it as open source, putting my own time and money and for equipment, etc. So somewhere in 2016, I said, okay, I'm putting my own time and money. Time is one thing, I'm enjoying doing it. So, I mean, I don't really mind that as much, but I'm also putting in my own money. What can I cover my costs, right? So there are, so Ostinato has been cross-platform from day one. It works on Windows, Mac, Linux, all the various flavors of Linux, Raspberry Pis and stuff like that. And there's this website hosting and all that. So all of this are costs that come in. I thought, at least let me try and cover my costs. So that's where the original thought came in. And so I started experimenting with what is called as monetization. So before I actually went and monetized the source code, I said, let me start with what everyone starts with, which is ads. So I enabled Google AdSense on the website and said, this is back in 2016. I said, let me see if that gets in any ads. So I got a couple of $100 over a couple of months, and then suddenly stopped working, and I couldn't figure out. I hadn't changed anything, and it just stopped working. And I talked to people, and they said, "Yeah, that happens sometimes." So, and what is the way to fix it? Is no one really knows. Try a bunch of things. I mean, just throw stuff at the dartboard and see what happens.
Right.
So I wasn't interested in doing
Google
that.
Dark Google change the agreement, and you pray that they don't change it further.
Yeah, so I did the next thing that, you know, open source people do. We ask for donations. And I discovered the first hand that people are not willing to donate. So that was also a trickle, even less than the what the ads made. And that's when I said, okay, what next can I try? And so that's when I thought, why not charge for, I mean, keep the source code free, but charge for the convenience of pre-built installers, right? For installers for Linux, Windows, Mac OS. Just charge some nominal amount and see if that works. Again, all of these were experiments. I hadn't. I was just evolving stuff, trying various things. And
That first step was okay, I'm going to give... I'm still going to give away the source code. Still going to be open source. So if you want to compile it for your platform, go for it. That's on you. If you want a pre-built binary so you can just click the easy button to get it installed, you got to pay for that. So you're providing some value there. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But essentially what you're paying for is convenience, right? You don't have to go build if you're not a developer. I mean, on the website, there are instructions on how to download the source and build and so on, but you don't want to do it. Right? You just want to just download, click, install, run, right?
Yeah.
So that was what I started. And I started with, I mean, again, I'm coming from an open source world, right? So I don't know whether people are willing to pay for this. So I started with what you call the pay what you want model, with a minimum as zero, which means you could still get it for free. And so what used to be like more than 100 downloads per day suddenly turned to like two digits downloads, about 60, 70 downloads per day, because suddenly people were faced with this screen where they said enter a price. And although it said very clearly that enter zero to get it for free, people don't read these days. So they said, oh, what is this? I won't pay. And so that went down. And then some people paid. And then I said, okay, what if I increase the minimum value to $1? And that's when I really felt it. Downloads dropped to like one single digit per day.
Wow. Just for $1?
Yeah, just for $1. And since then, I kept increasing the $1 to like $5, $10, $15. And then I realized that whatever amount you send as the minimum, most people will tend to pay that. At least the people who are willing to pay, they will pay that. Very few will actually pay more. So I said, okay, this doesn't, I mean, there's not much point doing this pay what you want, because, I mean, as a means of validating whether people are ready to pay, maybe that has served its job, but let me just change over to a fixed price. Because anyway, people are just paying the minimum, whatever I'm setting as minimum, that's what they're paying. And so that's where it ended. So with a fixed price, and that's when a new thought came to me that can I make a income from this, at least a secondary supplementary income, and that could possibly become a full-time income years later. And I was
Yeah, so
also
before
sort
we get
of
into that, I want to ask, because we're talking about open source, was there an outcry? People were like, how dare you bring money into this? How dare you charge for this software? Did you get pushback?
Oh yes, some people asked and said things politely, others not so much. But yeah, and then you had to go and explain to them that open source does not mean you can't charge for it. In fact, Stallman wrote a whole article about go and charge as much as you can for your open source software. And the whole free is free as in freedom, not free as in beer stuff. So, I mean, stuff that you have sort of grew up with, but people don't
Yes.
know. And then they'll give you the innocent and naive advice. I mean, they're coming from a good place, but they'll tell you, no, you should give away your software for free and just charge for support. And that support model doesn't work. I think Red Hat is probably the only company that has made some business out of support. And even I think after they sale to IBM, that is now questionable, I think.
Yes.
So the support model didn't work. So yeah, I got a lot of pushback about why are you charging?
Let's pause the conversation for a message from sponsor Palo Alto Networks. 2023 is a year when companies are going to need to do more with less. As businesses grapple with economic uncertainty, it's more critical than ever to consolidate fragmented security and networking solutions to reduce operational complexity and costs. Palo Alto Networks has a new virtual event on its Prisma SASE, where AI-powered innovation takes center stage. You can watch this event on demand and see how ZTNA 2.0, Cloud Secure Web Gateways, and SD-WAN deliver exceptional security and ROI. Hear how the latest innovations in SASE can help your organization automate costly and complex IT operations with AI-powered digital experience management, connect and secure branch offices and the hybrid workforce with SD-WAN, ZTNA 2.0, and Cloud Secure Web Gateways, and unlock better ROI through consolidation of point solutions with Prisma SASE. Watch this event on demand at paloaltonetworks.com/engage/sassy-signature-moment. That's paloaltonetworks.com/engage/sassy-signature-moment. And now back to the podcast.
There's an idealism with open source, but it's on both sides. I mean, there's zealots who are open source creators and maintainers that have that sort of vibe, free as in freedom. Everything should be free. Information wants to be free, and so on. But then there's also the entitled side, I guess, that comes with it. I've talked to enough open source folks to know that there's a lot of difficulty building and maintaining these projects, and you got to be respectful of anyone that is making something. And then you said most people are like that, but you've just got the bad apples that make it ugly. So okay, so
Especially,
now
for
you're,
people like me who are doing this on the side, right? I had a full-time day job, and you know how these networking day jobs are. They're not like 8-hour jobs. So doing something out of passion because I believe in something, I want to do something. And then when people start making unreasonable demands, it really puts you down.
So now you've made these changes. Now you're at that transition point where it's like, can I make a living out of this? And so what are the next steps? What changes did you make beyond that? 'Cause now you're charging for downloads, but have you done more at this point?
Yeah, so I tried a bunch of experiments, right? So all of this time, remember, things are evolving. I started with something, I just thought I'll give away for free. People will come and use, people will come and contribute stuff back. We'll grow as a community, and not much of that happened. But I continued to believe in the open source stuff, and I started charging, saying at least let me be compensated for what I'm putting in. And so I ran a several experiments, right? So for one example, as I said, right, Ostinato has been cross-platform from day one. So there were binaries for Windows, Mac, Linux, Raspberry Pi, VMs, containers, etc. So I started, so all of them were like separate purchases. So I said, okay, why not make this simpler? The pricing page looks cluttered. Let me consolidate them into bundles and tiers, right? So you either you buy a single one of them, or you can buy a whole big bundle of all of them. So, of course, if you buy a bundle, you pay much more so that you get everything that is there. I again experimented with increasing pricing. And then another interesting thing that I did was I added some closed source add-ons. Now, by this time, you can figure out as getting slightly cynical with the open source model and things were not working the way I thought I would like it to work.
Right.
So I added a bunch of, so the whole open core model, right? To keep the core as open source and add proprietary stuff around it. Uh-huh. So I, the API automation API, Python API, I added as a add-on that you could, you needed to pay for. And then there was this the turbo line rate support to get 10 gig, 40 gig or 100 gig line rate. This is a separate add-on. And again, this is closed source and proprietary. The thinking behind this was, right, when I was charging for binaries, you were paying for convenience. Here, you would pay for value. That was my thought process. In fact, my hope was that if the add-ons made enough, right, maybe I could make the base software again, you could get it for free, but hope is not success. So that never happened.
As you were experimenting, were you potentially looking at other open source projects that were also going down this route, adding closed sourced proprietary elements that you had to pay for as examples?
Right. So the open core model was really becoming popular around this time. Right. And I was clued in onto the community and people were saying, do this, it works, do that. But, you know, what works for one person doesn't work for another person. And so all of these experiments was based on those sort of interactions. And then people said, no, we want a trial version. So I tried running a survey as to what is stopping you from purchasing. So they said, no, we want to try before we buy. So I created a trial version. Uh-huh. And then I realized that when I made it available front and center, it cannibalized all my sales. So people would download the trial version and then never convert. And so then I started hiding that trial version behind a survey that people who said they want a trial version, I would give that link to them. And from them, then I figured out that only about 50% of people who downloaded would actually even install it. Forget running it, right?
Right.
And then, so I said, okay, how can I address this deficiency? So I made this is desktop software, right? So, but using the WebAssembly technology, which had come by the time, I converted that desktop app to a web app and made a demo version available on the website that you could actually try the software in the browser tab. You don't have to download and run, at least a couple of steps are cut off. So, I mean, right now the web demo is still up and I'm still experimenting with it.
And at the time you were doing all this, was it still a side project?
Yeah. So some of this was still a side project and some of these things. So the web demo happened after I went full time on it, but okay. The other stuff happened before. And of course, all of this while I'm making these product changes, I'm also trying a bunch of marketing, SEO, conversion optimization, those sort of stuff, right? All of that is also happening in parallel.
So can you explain that transition then from side project to full-time?
Yeah, so that is fairly recent, right? 2022. And there were really multiple reasons for that. So one was, I mean, while all this was happening, I sort of also got interested in the whole FIRE movement, financial independence, retire early stuff. Uh-huh. And the whole freedom aspect was something that resonated with me. I figured that maybe Ostinato could become a vehicle for me to reach that FIRE goal. And the whole freedom aspect is like, you know, it still is very strong, resonates very strongly with me because while doing a full-time day job and doing Ostinato on the side, I've ignored my other passions, right? Primarily music. I've just given up on that. And it's something that I regret and miss very badly. And so to be able to do reach the FIRE goal and to be able to get back to that aspect of my life was like a beacon call. And all this while, I was also getting sort of disenchanted with my work. So I've worked for about 25 years now. Mm-hmm. And I work in the data plane, which is like sort of same thing again and again, just try and push bits and bytes as fast as possible while running a bunch of features. And I was not learning anything much new. I was not happy with the growth I had within the company as well. And So yeah, so I mean, in the meantime, there was one thing that where we did a complete rewrite of the line card software. So that was good. Otherwise, you're just adding stuff there and making sure your performance is still not degrading too much. And so doing a complete rewrite was like, for a software developer, that's like Mecca. So so that was nice for some time. Then I figured, no, I mean, I don't like the way they're doing this rewrite. I have very strong opinions about it, and I don't like the way they're doing this. So, but the final trigger really, you know, was during COVID. I lost my manager at work to COVID. Uh-huh. And that was like a real wake-up call for me. I mean, I'd known that he was a colleague of mine before he became my manager. And I'd known him for 10 years, and we would have lunch together. And, you know, like all IT people, right? We would talk about, you know, I want to make X money, that a few money, and then I'm going to quit my job. And so that was like a wake up call for me that, you know, I'm trying to reach this number and the life is so unpredictable. I mean, what am I even doing here? In this quest to reach this number, I think I'm ignoring a lot of important things. And
so you almost had like an existential awakening in some ways.
True. Yeah. I mean, that hit me really hard. I mean, so that was the trigger, but it still took me a year after that to really have the courage to quit, because after 25 years of a steady paycheck, it's not easy to suddenly give all that up.
Yeah.
And, I also had to ensure that I had a long runway for me to experiment. I mean, at 25 years of experience, it's not going to be easy getting another job. So, I mean, before I, you know, in a fit of idealism, say I'm going to quit and do something else, I need to make sure I have enough money to at least last me a few years to experiment with stuff. So, yeah, so it took me another year. And so, yeah, so 2022 is when I went full time.
Okay.
So, okay, you're full time with this now. You have been for going on a couple of years. And now the paid versus free offerings are very, very, very interesting statistic to you. It's your livelihood at this point. Do you know what percentage of Austin Auto users are free versus how many have become paid over the years?
So I have no means of finding that out. That's actually impossible for me to say. I can't even hazard a guess. And the reason is, I didn't put any telemetry or analytics or anything of that sort, right? To try to figure out who is how downloading, who is using. I mean, it was primarily, I started building it because it was something that I wanted. And I personally am a privacy advocate. I don't like this user tracking and so on. So I didn't build it in stuff that I am making. And now 2010 was a completely very different era, right? Today in the SaaS era, I mean, it's a given that everything what you're doing is being tracked, and you're being given hints and stuff that, oh, you should do this now and you should do this. It's now treated as something helpful. That was not, I mean, culturally, we have changed, right? We now accept more of this, that AI is reading my email and suggesting stuff. We become more accepting of it now, which is not the case earlier. So I never put in any of that. Plus, there was a technical problem, right? So most of the deployment where Austin Auto is used is within labs, which don't have direct internet access, right? So they're air-gapped environments. They can only access the corporate network and one way. And even virtual lab environments like EVNG or GNS3, if you add a node there, they don't have internet access unless you specifically provide internet access, right? So even if I had put in stuff, right? I mean, I thought about putting this stuff, then I realized it's probably not going to help. Because they don't have access to the internet for me to collect any sort of data.
So it's still open source right now. You're still soldiering on with Austin Auto offering that the open core model, I think you described it as. You're still doing that. Do you think you're going to transition Austin Auto to be completely closed source at some point?
So this is the big question facing me right now. It's what I've been thinking of. While I'm sleeping, while I'm in the shower, it's sort of, it's a big decision for me. And I think I'm going to pull that plug now. I think I owe it to myself. I think I owe it to the product. And I'll tell you why I think like that. So I've tried open source for like 14 years. it hasn't worked the way I have, would have liked it to work. And I feel that continuing with open source now, it's like I'm shackling myself, right? I'm adding restrictions to myself or to the product success where I don't need to, right? So what does open source get me today, right? I mean, apart from my own belief in it and me wanting it to be open source, if I look at it a pragmatic and practical way, what is open source getting me or the product? So from a community contributions point of view, if I look at how many commits were contributed, that's like less than 1%. Even from a lines of code point of view, that's like 1 or 2%, right? So essentially that whole thing about, you know, the community will join and contribute hasn't happened.
So as in no maintainers, you're the one who's writing, developing, adding new features, fixing bugs, and no one's come alongside you after all these years and said, Srivats, I want to really do some work in Asta now. I think it's an awesome product. Let's get into this code base together and really, really work on this as a team. That never happened.
No, that never happened. And so, I mean, I will make a distinction between maintainer and contributor. So contributor gives maybe contributes a particular set of a bunch of features or bug fixes or stuff like that. A maintainer is one who has the commit access and will merge the whole code and make sure that it is fine and quality checks are there and so on. So even from the contribution point of view, there have been a couple of small bug fixes, but other than that, nothing major has been contributed. So, I mean, they don't have to commit to it. Once they contribute, the maintainer takes over and takes it ahead. But so even from a contribution point of view, that has been very minimal. And the other aspect of open source, which is supposed to help, is the community aspect on the mailing list or forums. When other users ask questions, there are community members who would help. So for a long time, I tried, right? I would see that mail. I would sit on it for 2-3 days, see if someone else would jump in and answer. And only then I would get in, right? Instead of jumping myself, because then I set a precedent that people just expect me to jump in for everything. So I wanted to see that, whether if someone else will help. So there were a few people who did. Then, like most open source communities, they are like passerbys, right? They've been here for some time. They moved on. Their interests have moved on. They're doing something else now. They were using this for a project, so they're interested in it. Now their project is no longer there, so they moved on. And then I discovered that now I'm having to jump with on everything. So, right? So even from the support point of view or helping others, not much is happening on the community front. In the sense, if I put it in another way, I have sort of failed to build a community, whether it be a contributor community or a support community. So I sort of treat it as a failure on my part.
Well, it is a niche product, right? What Ostinato does. So originally packet crafting, and then it became traffic generation. And you said like it ended up in a lot of labs, people that are doing test work with it, putting loads on network wires and so on. And I know some of the add-on packages you've got, you can really put some traffic through this thing. It's 100 gig now, right?
100 gig now.
Yeah. So you can, it really does a lot, but there's not everybody in the world needs this. I mean, there's a lot of folks that can use it for different things, but their needs are going to tend to be temporary. So I think that might be part of the challenge, with the community. It's not like GNS3 is a huge community. Why? Well, because everybody wants a lab platform. Same with EVNG and container labs building up a community and so on. It's just that the commonality of that. What Ostinato does is super cool if you need what it does, right? So, I mean, that's got to be part of the challenge for you. But still, some of the people that use this, they really need it. You know what I mean? There's some of the alternatives are incredibly pricey and expensive commercial products that do what they do that you for a long time were basically giving away. You'd think there'd be enough interested parties to be like, oh, we got to get behind this thing. Let's make this thing go because this is solving a problem for us and it's doing it very cost effectively. So I'm surprised no one knocked on the door at some point for you.
Yeah, I don't know. I also probably as an introvert, I didn't reach out and market myself as much. And, interesting that you said about, not building a community. So one thing I figured out, right, that was an insight that I had. So when I built it for myself and I'm a developer. So I'm not on the network engineer on the ops side, right? But then when I ran a survey, I figured out that the most users are actually network engineers. They're not programmers or developers. So I can't expect them to contribute that. So that's not just not going to happen.
Well, what's the source code? The source code is written in what?
It's in C++, right? So maybe
there's another challenge. Yeah, boy.
So if it's Python or something, maybe someone would fool around and mess around. But with C++, that chances were very less. And as you said, right, it's very niche, right? Only when you need it. And like network engineers also, even if they are the users, their network engineers are more concerned with config. They want to do a show route, see the route has been populated, OSPF has exchanged the route, or BGP has exchanged the route. Things look good. And as long as they see the route in the fib, they assume things are fine. Very rarely would network engineers need to actually send data plane traffic to verify whether the fib has been programmed correctly indeed and traffic is flowing, right? And ping and trace route gets you a long way. You can just do a ping. And so only for things, for example, like multicast, right? You might not be able to work with ping. You might need specialized software to send IGMP or multicast data. Or if you want to test QoS, for example, that would be another place where you would try different DSCP values and so on to make sure your QoS policies are working correctly. So there are these very, again, these are all insights that I have gained over the years. As an open source stuff, right, it's a very low touch thing. You get to hear from people only when they face problems. Otherwise, right, they're using it. You don't even know whether they're using it. You don't know if they're using it successfully. You don't know what they are using it for. Only when they run into a trouble. I mean, some, when they can't figure it out, will just give up. Or this doesn't work. This is crap software, right? If they had reached out, I would have told them, no, this is a mistake you were making. Do it like this and it'll work. Mm-hmm. Of the people who reach out and then I try to figure out what they're doing. So again, that's a problem with open source, right? Because of the just people just go to the website, download, run.
Right. So I'm curious if you have any lessons for folks who might be thinking about doing an open source project, not on the software side, but on the community building side. You said that was something you felt like you didn't do a good job in. Would you have done things differently?
I would have done things differently, just I don't know how differently. Right. I mean, I don't have any advice to give because I know that I didn't do a good job, but what could I have done differently? I don't have a clue. I mean, honestly, because I tried a bunch of things, right? So for people who would help answer questions at the forum, I would offer them some free software and so on, stuff like that. I said I try to encourage people. So even before I did those add-ons, right? So I would encourage people that, okay, if you're ready to build an add-on, let me know what you need. I will build an interface for you, an API for you to work with. So the whole line rate turbo thing, for the longest time, I didn't do it because I expected someone from the community to pick it up. I wanted to focus on the core architecture and have the APIs and everything. And I thought the community will come and build the stuff around it on top of it, which is at a much higher abstraction level. So only now I'm realizing that I think that's not happening. And I think I think it's not correct expecting that. I think I need to build that myself. Mm-hmm. And so that's another reason why I'm thinking of going closed sources. So today now I have to add features, right? And I want to add, let's say, premium features or pro features. How do I manage two code bases, right? I mean, if one is an open source code base, which does not have a feature, but another needs to have that feature, I cannot manage two code bases. With the add-ons, it was easier because it was really an add-on. Architecturally, I could still work with it as an add-on. But if I go to the core product, it's difficult to manage two code bases, completely different code base. Again, as I said, right? So all of these things, I've now started feeling that I'm just restricting myself. Right. And somewhere in me, I very strongly still feel that there is still a need for this project, for this product. There is a space for this product. The product wants to exist. And me, by being dogmatic about, no, I want this to be open source, I think I'm denying that. And not that I'm expecting that once I go closed source, all the open source people are going to come and pay me. Most of them are not. That is not the reason really that I'm switching to closed source. But like I said, right, if I again want to continue with this, I want to try some pro features, premium features. I want to be able to manage the code base. I can't manage two different code bases. There's just, and if I want to grow this, right now I'm one person, I wear all the hats, right? So, okay. I mean, the developer is one thing, but there's a whole bunch of other things you have to do, right? There's support, you do marketing and sales, you do a bunch of updates on the websites. And at some point I want to be able to hire or contract out some parts of it so that, you know, yeah. The product grows, I can focus on something instead of constantly wearing different hats every day. Yeah. And to do all that, the revenues have to come up to the level where it needs to grow up to where it's more than what I need for myself. So it's not there yet. And I still haven't been able to match my own last day job salary. So so that's why I'm thinking, if it doesn't work, I'll just, you know, I mean, one thing is to just say, okay, I'm walking away from this, right?
Yeah.
But somewhere, as I told you, right, I believe that the product needs to exist and I want to give it that shot. I want to give it that chance. So I'm going to bet on myself and see if this change will help me do that.
So the next challenge would be from building a community to building a company, essentially.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so at difficult. This point, gone from open source, it sounds like you've all but committed to going to closed source because that seems to be your best path forward. So back to our opening question, you were passionate about open source back in the day. Do you still believe in open source like you once did?
So now that I have seen the other side, right? The maker's side, not the user's side. I have to admit I'm much, much more cynical about open source, right? And so I mean, I have to step back. I'll say I have a more rounded and nuanced view of open source, right? It's I still believe in it, but I also very strongly believe that it needs to change and evolve if it has to survive. Otherwise, I mean, we've already seen a bunch of, from open source to now we've gone to source available, right? I think Redis was the most recent one, which has gone from BSD to source available. So, mm-hmm. I mean, there's challenges that are being felt everywhere in the open source community.
Yep.
And in fact, Bruce Perens, who coined the open source definition and set up OSI, he himself is now talking about post-open world. He's acknowledging that open source has failed developers. Mm. And within the open source community itself, there is a lot of recognition that things haven't panned out exactly the way we would have liked. And a set of people, the developers, maintainers, are really struggling. And this doesn't bode well for open source as such.
Well, it's one of the things that hasn't come up in this conversation, but that is pretty well known. A lot of the major open source projects that are out there are backed by corporate interests. There are developers that are paid by companies to work on that open source project because that company has a vested interest in that project. And so, yeah, it's open source, but it's not someone on a volunteer basis as a side hustle writing all of this code. It's someone who's, or maybe a team of developers even, that are paid and compensated to work on that code base. Again, not your situation, but that's pretty common, I think, especially with some of the major open source projects that we know about in networking.
Right. Even otherwise, right? I mean, one is the company has a vested interest, or there's also sometimes some altruistic interest or some advertising interest, for example, Wireshark, right? So Wireshark has always had a corporate sponsor. So although it's not something that's a vested interest, but there is an altruistic interest or marketing interest or stuff like that. No one approached me ever for corporate sponsorship either. And I also never reached out. And I always wanted to keep it small. And for example, there is this whole very flourishing commercial open source systems, right? The whole COS movement. There's a VC money who are now funding COS open source and stuff. Again, these are a small subset of projects where the VC thinks there is money to be made, where the open source is like the top of the funnel, so on. And in fact, someone did once approach me for that, but I didn't want to take VC money. For me, the bootstrapped lifestyle and not being not exchanging one boss to another boss, it's an important thing. And so I'd rather make less money and keep it small. I had no dreams of, you know, having a huge exit or being written up in the press or anything of that sort.
Any parting thoughts for us, Srivats?
Yeah, so I mean, so it's just a disclaimer. I think I should probably lead with this right at the top of the episode. So this is my story of my project, right? This is not a general open source story. Of course, there are many successful open source projects, some backed by big companies, some small, some even individual success stories. But if there's one takeaway that I would like all the listeners to take away is my story, it may be my story, but it is not an outlier. It's probably the norm in the open source world, the challenges that we face. So be kind to maintainers. I think that will be my parting thought. If you're using an open source software, please be kind to maintainers. Finally, I mean, if all of this has come off as a little ranty and selfish, I apologize. I'm just narrating my story of how I got to where I've gotten to.
Now, Ostinato is the project that we've been talking about. That's been your baby for all these years. Where do people find out more about Ostinato?
Yeah, ostinato.org is the website. And you can reach me on Twitter if you want to reach to me personally. So this, my Twitter handle is Srivats P in reverse. That's likely, you know, what we do to get Twitter handles. It's P-S-T-E-A-B-I-R-S. I think just search for Srivats P in Twitter and you'll find it. Or just go to LinkedIn. I think LinkedIn is the best shot where you'll find me.
And we'll have links to all of that for Srivats and for the Ostinato project on our show notes at packetpushers.net. So thank you for listening to Heavy Networking all the way to the end. If you have a use case for Ostinato in your lab or your place of business, and when you want to support a solopreneur with a great product, visit ostinato.org and connect with Srivats on LinkedIn. You can visit packetpushers.net to find all our podcasts created for your professional career development. The latest additions to our podcast lineup include Network Automation Nerds with Eric Chow and Packet Protector with JJ Manella and Drew Conroy Murray, who you heard here today. While you're clicking around our website, take a moment to sign up for our newsletters, Human Infrastructure and Packet Capture, along with our community Slack channel. All of those are free resources for you. I have been your heavy networking host, Ethan Banks. Connect with me on LinkedIn or send me your follow-up about this episode to packetpushers.net/FU, FU for follow-up. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.